Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's 10:30 in the morning on February 6th, 2015. My name's Larry Jacobs. This is K-12 Education Talk Radio. And we're going to do a show today about taking the reins of writing assessment, presented by our good friends over at the National Council of Teachers of English, good old NCTE. Thank you, Millie, for helping me set up today's show. We have Chris Gallagher from Northeastern University and Eric Turley, who's an English teacher in Kirkwood, Missouri at good old Kirkwood High School. And I seem to be saying good old a lot today. All right, and we'll bring them on in just a second. I want to make sure everybody knows that the show will be archived at education-talkradio.org and tweeted out at EduTalkRadio. We hope that you take a few minutes and follow us, as I know Eric is doing. Eric Turley, he tweets at TurleyKHS, and I'll follow him if he follows me, and I know he's racing to his computer right now to do that. Thank you, Great Books Foundation, for sponsoring today's show. Out of balmy Chicago, the independent nonprofit educational organization whose mission is to empower readers, hear that, of all ages to become more reflective thinkers. There's an idea. Through the discussion of written works and ideas of enduring value, they offer educators a wide range of literature anthologies, nonfiction materials, other classroom products that empower K-12 students to become independent readers and thinkers, and schools that integrate great books, materials, and their shared inquiry method of learning into their curriculum create school success. That's the bottom line, by improving their students' critical thinking, reading comprehension, writing, speaking, and listening skills. Go over, check it out, greatbooks.org, and they tweet at greatbooksfnd. And so without further ado, from the warm, balmy weather of Boston, Massachusetts, where I understand the sidewalks won't be clear until May, and from Magnificent, just outside of St. Louis, I present to you Chris Gallagher and Eric Turley. Let's start with Chris. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Larry.
How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks.
That's good. And how deep is your car buried under the snow?
Pretty deep. I've been taking the train in this week, and despite the delays, it's probably been better than driving.
If you can even get to your car, a friend of mine's girlfriend's car is under 13 feet of snow. He can't even get to it or something where they plow. It's just unbelievable. Yeah, I live in Maine, by the way, so I feel your pain.
Yeah.
Okay. And Rick, are you there?
I'm here, Larry. Yep.
Yeah. Do you like Rick or Eric? What do you like?
Eric. Yep. Eric's fine.
Eric. No problem. Eric Turley is an English teacher at Kirkwood High School in Kirkwood, Missouri. Chris, as I said, is writing program director and professor of English at Northeastern University in Boston, where his car won't be ready till May. Okay, and tell us about the Kirkwood High School, Kirkwood, Missouri.
Eric. Sure, Kirkwood High School is located outside of St. Louis. We have close to 1,900 students at our high school. We are a unified district, one high school district, and lots of exciting things happen here. Great students, great community support. So it's a good place to be.
Absolutely excellent. And Chris, what do you do? Just tell people what you do over at the Northeastern, just so they can get it, besides your title.
Sure. I'm actually now Associate Dean of Teaching and Learning in the College of Social Sciences and Humanities. So I'm actually no longer directing the writing program, although I deal with it quite frequently. It's such a big program.
And I expect then that your memos that go out will be written properly. Would that be correct?
That's the hope. I'm mostly working with assessment and curriculum with the different programs across the university and really trying to help shape the teaching culture here at the university.
Oh, nice. That's a great way to put it. Thank you for that. You guys wrote a book together, Our Better Judgment, which is available from NCTA, and I guess IRA, it says here, NCTE IRA Standards for the Assessment of Reading and Writing. Am I reading this correctly, or am I doing this right? The book is called Our Better Judgment, and it's a long URL. I'll just say go to NCTE/ Our Better Judgment on Google, and it'll probably pop you right over there. All right, and let's start with Professor Chris, okay? The book's about writing assessment, okay? Our Better Judgment. Okay, talk about what you mean by the title of that, Chris, and then we'll go over to Eric. And by the way, before we start, how'd you guys get together? What are you doing hanging around with an English teacher in high school for? What's going on there, Chris? Right.
Yeah, so Eric and I met actually in Nebraska. I was on the faculty at the University of Nebraska, and he was a doctoral student there. And we have shared interests in writing assessment and school reform. And so once he got his degree, we started talking and writing together, and we had published a piece in English Journal on rubrics, which we can talk about later if you want. But I think it was largely for that reason that NCTE and Kathy Fleischer reached out to the two of us to work on this book together.
Nice. That's a good story. Anything to add to that, Eric? Did you get
your
doctorate? Are you a doctor?
I did, yep.
Early?
Yep, I am. I got the doctorate. Studied with Chris. He's an awesome mentor, and he just is a great guy to work with and write with, and so it was a pleasure to write the book.
Eric,
and
Eric,
again,
he's already graded you. Eric,
yeah,
he's
right.
already graded you. Tell the truth. Tell
great
the truth about him. Tell
what
the
I really
truth about
do,
him.
I really want to thank Kathy Fleischer, though, for inviting us to write this book, to give us the opportunity for it, because it was a lot of fun to do, to think together, but then also to talk to teachers. A lot of our book focuses on vignettes of teachers sharing the great practices they do with students every day in the classroom. So,
nice. That's great. Thanks, guys. That's always appropriate for the audience to hear how the two co-authors got together. Okay, so now, your book is called Our Better Judgment. It's about taking the reins of writing assessment, which is subjective, if I may. So talk to me about the better judgment of teachers. Chris, you do this when assessing student writing.
Sure. So our better judgment refers to the judgment, as you might imagine, of teachers. And the notion that informs the book is that teachers are in the best position to understand and support the work of writers in their classrooms, as opposed to remote policymakers or test makers, because they're the ones who spend their days with the kids. And so a big piece of this is about writing assessment taking place in and emerging from the classroom and empowering the people who are spending their days with kids to really become assessment literate and assessment experts and assessment leaders. And we can talk more about that sort of trajectory if you want in a bit. But on the notion of judgment, what's really important to us there is to think about what that term means in a couple of different ways. So we do certainly want to empower professional judgment so that teachers understand that the sort of wisdom that they gain from reflective practice is a really important piece of education and should be driving reform. But we also want to think about the ability to make judgments on student work. And there we're thinking about, again, teachers being well-positioned to do that. They could certainly use tools that emerge from other places, so they can use all kinds of assessments, but it's really their critical, informed judgment based on observation and experience with kids that we think should be driving school reform and writing assessment,
and
of course.
Of course, and since you're the college professor, the professor of English, and formerly the writing program director at Northeastern, okay, in Boston again, did you feel, and again, I said it at the beginning, writing is subjective, okay, and are teachers being trained well, and I'm going to segue right over to Eric in a minute with the same question, are teachers being trained well to do this? So we're going to get into the details of the book in a second, but it is, you know, how do you teach subjectivity, if I may?
Yeah, I mean, for me, so I think the short answer to your question is it's uneven, right? That there are places where they're doing this quite well, and I think Eric can give you some great examples from the work that he's done with colleagues, and then there are other places where that's not happening. What I'm worried about is that we take the premise that this is a subjective activity, and we try to get around that and make it objective by creating these tests that...
Oh, I see.
In assessment language, you might say it underrepresents the construct, which is to say we've long given writing assessments that have been, because we want them to be objective, they test things like correct spelling, or the ability to use particular kinds of punctuation, but outside of the context of their use, because the notion is that's objective. What we really want to do is to say, no, of course it's subjective, it's always going to be subjective, but that doesn't mean it's unfair, and that doesn't mean that it's that it isn't based on really close critical observation by people who know what they're doing. So what you want to do is, I think, make really good use of subjectivity in the process. As writers, we know this is true. We get all kinds of feedback to our writing, and we have to parse our way through it, work our way through that feedback, and figure out what are we going to use, what are we going to throw away, and how do we make good judgments as writers. That's what we want for our kids, too. So we want them to be able to use subjectivity rather than pretend writing and writing assessment are objective.
And just to make light of it, that if my English teacher had done this, James Joyce would not be published today.
Right.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's simple. Eric, your thoughts on that question, you know, taking into account the subjectivity of writing assessment, that sort of thing, and what you're doing over at Kirkwood High. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. Well, you know, I think working with teachers, you know, I've been teaching in some capacity for about 15 years, and I think it's really interesting how teachers who've been working with kids for years and decades often kind of are resistant to think that they're qualified to make judgments. They feel like that's a scary thing,
that they don't
see themselves as having the expertise to do that. And yet, when you think about it, you know, when you're working with students in the classroom, when you're reading their work, you are one of the most qualified. And so I think thinking about that title, Our Better Judgment, I think one of the things our book tries to help teachers think through is, you know, how can we make better judgments about our students, about their writing, and about the work that they do? And so we kind of talk about, you know, and we'll talk about this more, but how we can, you know, become assessment literate. We can learn to ask really great questions, think about methodologies, ways that we might answer that question. Once we have some information, what we can do with that information. And really, when you start talking to teachers like that, they say, well, I do that all the time, or I didn't know that was called assessment, you know? And it's like, well, sure, you know, assessment is an inquiry-driven activity where you start with something that you don't know about. You want to know something, and then you pose questions and try to figure out, to the best of your ability, how to get answers. And then what's exciting from my point of view is, you know, those answers are what yields change in a classroom and ultimately change in our students and their writing.
And then just the one last thing,
I think as we make these as we make subjectivity a thing that we talk about with our students, that, you know, different readers will give you different forms of feedback, as Chris kind of alluded to, you know, while our book's really about helping teachers make better judgments, as teachers, we want our students to make strong judgments about their work and their writing. And so really, you know, good assessment practice in a classroom will ultimately help students when they leave our classrooms to think and deliberate upon their words and the impact it has out in the public sphere.
Well said. And just as a curiosity, just taking Kirkwood, what was the name of that great thing? 50 years ago, they did a thing about another, I can't think of the name of the suburb in St. Louis. It was a CBS thing. It's famous about a day in the life of a high school. I can't remember which high school. Oh, Webster Groves. Webster Groves.
Do you remember that? Yes. Yeah, I actually live in Webster Groves, and that's Kirkwood's big rival. So, you know, for fear my principal's listening, I probably can't say too much about that right now. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Did you ever see it? It's called 16 in Webster Groves, and it's classic. It used to be, anyway. Have you ever seen that thing?
You know what? I've not seen it. I've heard it, but recently one of the local papers, I guess some of the Webster teachers kind of went through a day of the, you know, being a high school student, and they were kind of reflecting to the reporters what that experience was like. So,
and the reason I brought it up was because they took Webster Groves in Missouri, a suburb of St. Louis, as just a standard for the U.S. and what it was like to be in high school there, okay? And it was classic. It was made on CBS, and it was a documentary. It was classic for 50 years. It's probably gone by the wayside so quite a bit now. It's probably up on YouTube somewhere. But my point is, you're at Kirkwood High School, very obviously very close to there, okay? And just off the top of your head, how would you assess the kids' writing skills right now? Just generically, through the school, whatever you're doing. Curious.
Well, it's kind of like asking me, I have a son and a daughter, and to tell you the difference between them. I mean, you know, our students have, we have
If you don't know
prolific...
the difference between your son and your daughter, we have to have another whole conversation.
No. What I mean by that is, obviously, we have a range of students at Kirkwood High School, and we have some prolific writers. We have a wonderful journalism program. You know, overall, I think the biggest thing that I want, I try to push conversations towards is, how do we get students to write for real audiences? You know, we've done a really nice job for, you know, decades of teaching writing in a way that, you know, doesn't really get outside of our walls. And so any opportunities we have for students to write for real rhetorical purposes, you know, actually, you know, maybe there's a problem that needs to be solved in the community. Maybe there's an award that they're writing for. Maybe there's an issue that they want to raise. Maybe it's about doing some podcasts for some local organizations to get information out. From my vantage point, I think where we need to keep moving towards is, you know, students, you know, through the phones, through the explosion of digital composition, I mean, they're writing all the time, you know? And so how can we help teachers help students to make sense of the kind of digital and fast-paced world that they're living in and think about their words and the impact that they can have on the world? And so that's where I think, you know, I'd like to see our school and also schools around kind of really thinking hard about those types of questions.
And what you just said, which is interesting, and I've had conversations on this on the show before, kids are writing, whether they like to admit it or not, via texting, et cetera. They're writing now more than ever. They're writing now more than ever. So this is key stuff. I'm glad you brought that up, as a matter of fact. Okay, back to you, Dr. Gallagher. All right, the book blurb, and I love this. I love this. The book blurb says, in this age of accountability, teachers have been treated as targets of assessment, I love that, rather than agents of it. I mean, what a great phrase. They've been treated as targets rather than good agents of it. So, Chris, talk to me about why is it important for a teacher to understand that they are the agent and not its target? And this is across the board, okay? So it's really an important subject. Chris?
Sure. I mean, so a big piece of my work, and I know what Eric and I are both interested in, is the ways in which teachers often feel like they don't have professional control of their own work because they're handed curriculum often, they're handed assessment, and we all, you know, we've heard the phrase that, assessment drives instruction. We've heard the phrase, what gets measured is what gets taught. And those, I think, are, it's fair to say those are political realities, but they're educationally problematic. It's learning is what should drive instruction. And measurement and assessment can be part of that. But as Eric was describing earlier, teachers are, if they are teaching and learning well, they're also doing assessment because they're trying to figure out, when I teach, what are my students learning? And we've moved past the moment where we can simply say, well, I taught it and they didn't learn it, right?
So it's
important for them, again.
You must have been in my high school math class.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been saying that for a long time. I think that the tide has changed in a lot of ways. And the very nice thing about what's been going on in education recently has been that there is a focus on, a very tight focus on learning and learning for all kids. The not so nice part of that is the accountability piece that says, that's a one-way relationship that says, you teachers have to show me that you're doing your jobs, and I'm going to assume you're not doing it until you can show me the data that proves otherwise. And the way I'm going to ask you to do that is to hand you an assessment that'll prove how much students have learned. And so I don't think we want our kids to spend their days with people who don't feel like they have control over their own lives. I mean, they're the people with whom our students, our kids, spend so much of their time. So we want them to feel and to act as though and to really be empowered to use that phrase again, to take the reins of their own professional lives. And I think that's why it's so important for us.
Well, then continue on that, Chris, and I'll get back to Eric. How does a teacher do that? How do they take the reins in this age of pressure, really, assessment pressure,
let's
be honest? Yeah, I mean, it ain't easy. You know, that you said they're sometimes handed curriculum. If I can correct you, they're always handed curriculum. Not sometimes, it's always. Yeah.
I will say, I should add one more thing to my previous answer, which is that the word agent – comes out of the NCTE IRA standards, actually. So Our Better Judgment, the book, appears in the Principles and Practice series that NCTE and IRA publish, and they're one of their standards, in fact, the second standard, is the teacher is the most important agent of assessment. And so, in fact, and this leads right into your question, in fact, what we're trying to do is answer the question, well, what does that look like in practice, right? What do teachers need to do in order to become agents of assessment? And so we really organized the entire book to answer that question. And we've done
How long is the book? How long is the book?
Oh, it's about 800 pages. No, I'm kidding. It's probably...
Wow.
No.
Are you serious? No,
I'm not serious.
It's like War and Peace.
No.
It's about 100.
It's actually quite short. It's about 100 pages.
Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn present Our Better Judgment. No, go ahead.
Yeah. We did want to make it fairly short, very readable. The notion is we want to put it in teachers' hands and they can really make use of it. So the question you just asked me is, how does a teacher do this? Is really how we've organized the whole book. So we've got a chapter on building assessment literacy. We've got a chapter on developing assessment expertise, and we've got a chapter on exercising assessment leadership. So those are the three concepts that form the core of the book. And in each one of those, and we could certainly play out some examples if you like, in each one of those we've got examples from teachers' classrooms and sometimes from their community work as well, in which real teachers from across the country are describing and giving examples of the ways in which they've been able to, again, develop assessment literacy, expertise, and leadership. So what we do within the chapters is essentially we interviewed teachers, we gathered some materials from their classrooms, and then we crafted stories, essentially, that help our readers understand not just what those teachers did, but how they came to do it, if that makes sense.
Nice. That makes perfect sense. And by the way, we're both making an error. I'm going to correct you and me.
Okay,
and my pal Millie. Okay, the IRA, as you've been mentioning, is no longer the IRA. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Yes, I did.
It's now called...
It's now the ILA.
That's right. Thank you, Eric. The International Literacy Association. They changed their name on January 26th.
Okay, there you go.
There you go. IRA, just and everybody should know that. It's going to take a little while for it to sink in, is now the International Literacy Association, which is a name I like, by the way. And you can obviously redirects and everything, but it's ILA now. Okay, just so everybody understands that one. The other picture is your book. Your book sounds great. Is there a Cliff Notes or anything like that we should know about?
No, I'm telling you, it's quite short, quite readable.
Got to read the whole book. Okay, that's cool. I'm only kidding, guys. I'm only kidding. All right. So tell me then, Eric, let me swing over to you, okay? You take examples of great teaching. And by the way, is it just English teaching you use as examples, or is it social studies, science, whatever? Because they all need writing assessment, quite honestly. And what does an agent do? Yeah.
Sure, yeah. No, for our book, just because it is a little shorter, we have middle school and high school teachers of English primarily, who are, as Chris said, sharing their practice with us and how they help us to show what they do in their classroom. So, as someone who's brand new to this conversation about assessment can pick up the book and read it and recognize, oh, I do things like that in my classroom. I can add these things to it as well. So, as Chris said, it's divided into three sections. The first question is kind of how do you build assessment literacy? And as I kind of alluded to before, we talk about that, being literate is kind of a stance that you take. It's not about knowing a bunch of stuff. It's actually about a way of positioning yourself to ask meaningful questions about teaching and learning, to gather the information that you need on that, to analyze the information, and then ultimately to use that information for teaching and learning. And actually, Chris worked with a teacher named Anya, and I don't know if Chris wants to talk about her for a little bit, and then I can come back and tell you about some other teachers that I've worked with as well.
Well, if you want to go ahead. Tell us about Anya, Chris.
Sure. I mean, Anya is one of the examples in the Gaining Writing Assessment Literacy chapter, and the reason I think she's so interesting and useful to think with is that she began – so she was reworking her Holocaust section of her English course, essentially. And
you mean the Holocaust of World War? I'm going to tell you something interesting. You mean the Holocaust of World War II?
Yes.
Okay, just so you know, I did a show yesterday about teaching the Holocaust. There was a 9 a.m. show yesterday, February 5th. Okay, and it was done with a publisher called Gihon River Press. So if anybody's interested in it, they have a great curriculum for teaching the Holocaust. I will now let you go back on. I always like to jump back if I could tell people about a show we did.
Sure, that's great.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Anya realized is that she was putting a lot of pressure on students on the final project that was this big sort of culminating research paper at the end where they had studied some facet or feature of the Holocaust, and the kids weren't doing as well as she wanted them to do. Meanwhile, she was going to school and trying to write her thesis. And what she realized as a writer was that she really needed ways to break. She was facing the same problem. I've got this big thesis to write. Time is ticking away. I don't know if I'm making the right kind of progress on it. And so she worked with an advisor who helped her break down the process. Right, so let's develop some writing strategies that make sense for you. Let's try to figure out what kinds of activities will help you just get some writing done when you're in that space where you're feeling like you've got writer's block. And so she brought a lot of that stuff into the classroom and started experimenting with formative assessments, which is essentially assessments where the purpose is really to promote teaching and learning. You're not necessarily making an evaluative judgment at the end in the way that you would with a summative assessment, but you're using that as an opportunity to learn about, you know, where am I in the process, what am I doing well, what do I need to change. So the best example in the chapter, and we've got actual examples of this reproduced in the chapter, is a formative assessment where Anya asked her students to draw themselves as writers. And she did this at the beginning of the project, and most of what they drew, and we've got three examples in the book, are students describing some form of frustration. So they're pulling their hair out, or one of them is inside this sort of barely cracked egg and can't get out, right?
Great.
And then later on in the project, she asked them to draw themselves again after having done all of the sort of little pieces in between, and they represent themselves very differently as very successful writers, right? So one of them just says, I'm number one, I'm terrific, and this is a middle school. And another one drew a box and drew herself outside of it and said, you know, writing box here, right, with an arrow.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
the idea is that that's actually a form of writing assessment. We don't often think of it as writing assessment, but what she's doing in that moment is gathering information about who her students are as writers, what their attitudes about writing are, and then she's using that to try to move them forward. And what the big sort of takeaway for her for this activity was, even her most able writers in that first instance were drawing themselves in moments of frustration and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And she was sort of assuming, oh, you know, the ones who do quite well, they'll be fine, you know, and I'm going to spend most of my time really working with the other students. But no, actually what she learned was all of her students were struggling quite a bit early on in the process. And so she had all these checkpoints along the project now, instead of assuming that the larger thesis projects would end up, you know, sort of just appearing out of nowhere. And the students described themselves in much more positive terms. The grades were certainly much better. The work was richer. And for Anya, it was really about incorporating those formative assessments all along the way so that she and her students could be in conversation as writers. And again, I think a really nice piece of the story is that she was experiencing the same thing in her master's program. It's kind of a cool piece.
And that is so cool. And not only was, how do I want to say this properly, it's probably obvious, but not only was she getting an assessment point of view, but the kids were self-assessing at that point. I love
exactly,
it.
Exactly. And
yeah,
I think self-assessment is perhaps, you know, thoughtful self-assessment is perhaps the best outcome of good teacher-based assessment.
And well said, my friend. Well said. You had some. That's a great anecdote, by the way. Where does Anya teach, if I may ask, or what town, whatever?
She teaches on the North Shore in Massachusetts.
Ah, okay. I lived in Swampscott for many years, so I know the North Shore well. Okay.
Great.
And Yeah, and so all right, now to you, Eric. Okay, give us an example, another example of anecdotal example of assessment, taking the reins of assessment for writing.
Sure. You know, we talk in our book about those three things: literacy, expertise, and then leadership. Excuse the bell going off. It's a passing period right now in my school.
No, we're Education Talk Radio. School bells can go off. That's okay.
There you go. Okay, good. But, you know, that's really not like a linear trajectory. In fact, it's quite circuitous. You'll be going through those stages. You know, as you become gain expertise, you're also going to be, you know, reading, learning, thinking more, becoming more literate. So I don't want these to be thought of as three separate, you know, kind of stages of one's development. But one of the areas I really like, you know, being a teacher, is our chapter on expertise. And we talk about expertise as a dialogic relationship between your inquiry, you know, the questions you're asking, and then the practice that you're doing. And we showcase how teachers are collaborating together. They're working together to build their expertise. You know, we're not islands to ourselves, but when we meet together, we talk, we read together, we think together, that's where our expertise grows around assessment, and writing assessment in particular. And so I was able to talk with a teacher who teaches here in the St. Louis area. Her name was Angie. And she was talking about how her school has data teams, is what they call them there. You know, sometimes schools have PLCs, professional learning communities, things like that. And, you know, if you talk to a teacher, some teachers really love those experiences, and some teachers feel like, well, we're just kind of doing what the administration wants us to do here. But Angie's group really had a great opportunity to kind of shape the group and the dynamic and the questions. And so she shares this experience that she has. Angie happens to be another middle school teacher who was talking about, mm-hmm, how do we teach summary writing to our students. And so that PLC, she kind of, you know, walked us through the chronology of how this unfolded over a semester. But one of the most interesting things was when they first got together, the teachers disagreed on what makes a quality summary. And so they had to have this conversation. Well, what are we looking for? You know, if you think it's this and I think it's this, you know, what are we really doing? And so that drove the teachers to then go and read, like, where do people actually write summaries? Where do they exist in the real world? And they pulled examples from different genres and different places, disciplines and different places. And they kind of said, okay, so when we teach this to our students, we want to, you know, define summary as this, and here show some examples, have some model text like this. So that was a really just important moment there before they even looked at student writing, was to make sure they're kind of on the same page, or, you know, what is it that we're teaching our students and how are we articulating it to them. So Angie kind of tells a story and is how she goes to her classroom and she asks her students to write some, and she reads through those summaries, and she is noticing some things in her students that she didn't know if they were unique to her students or not, but she just kind of was keeping a list of, here's what I'm noticing. Later in the week, her data team met, and all the teachers came together with what they were noticing, and obviously there were some trends across all the teachers, and so what they did is they spent the time in that meeting talking about, okay, how can we address this? And they designed a lesson together, a couple lessons actually, and then they put that into practice, okay? And then there was kind of another cycle where students practiced some more, and then they came together, and then they read student examples from different classes, and they refined their practice again. And it was it's a really great example showing that, you know, it's not a fast thing. You know, we can't do this in one 30-minute meeting, but over the course of the semester, how the teachers are able to, you know, articulate and be clear for both themselves and their students on what they're asking them to do, to be in dialogue with each other, to be looking at real-life examples, to be sharing work across classrooms and across a school. And even by the end of it, you know, they still had things that they were noticing. And they said, well, you know, for example, like transitions was an issue that they still saw their students struggling with. And they said, well, this is something that we're going to have to keep continuing to teach next semester. You know, we taught it. We taught it a couple times. We've reinforced it.
But they didn't learn
we need
it.
To go back to it.
Yeah, but we taught it, but they didn't learn it. And the really bottom line is learning, as everybody knows.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. And so I think what's cool about that is how, you know, this group of teachers came together and really worked to solve this problem together, you know, and through that they had to go out and read things and learn together. And I think that's, you know, that's really what kind of keeps teachers excited about teaching is, you know, most teachers really love to learn. And so having that component is really a great thing. And just to highlight one other thing, we also talked about sometimes as a teacher, you know, we have our own expertise, but we need to borrow expertise from other people. And so we have a cool vignette of two teachers who were bringing in outside people from the community to basically read student work and give them an assessment of it. These students were kind of applying for jobs and writing cover letters and things like that. And so the teachers brought in people who would be reading these, and those people sat down with the students and gave them feedback and said, here's how, you know, anything from word choice to content, and they were giving them some feedback there. And the teachers were talking about how they did that and why they did that. It was because, you know, in one case, one teacher said, my student wants to be a firefighter. I know nothing about that. I have no idea, you know, what they would need to do that. So I brought in the fire chief, and the fire chief sat with these students and read their work and gave them feedback. And so that was example, again, of a teacher leaving their classroom. I mean, the key for this is getting outside of your classroom, though, right, and borrowing the things that we don't know and learning together. So that was for me one of all the chapters are fun to write, but this was the best one for me. So,
I don't know who that teacher was who brought in the fire chief. Okay,
yeah.
But I'm giving them right now a round of applause.
Okay, it was Deb and Keith.
Yeah. Wait a minute, the thing's going on forever. Who? What was the person's name?
They were Deb and Keith.
Deb and Keith, good job. I love that. And you know, I'm going to stop you for a second. I have a question to ask you. Okay, and you can chime in on this, Chris, if you want. You know, I was a social studies teacher, so they were the bane of my existence, but I would give essay questions. Okay? So I'd be marking them for the history. I'd be marking for the history of the social studies, wherever it might be. But even though I was close friends with most of the people in the English department, okay, I never even occurred to me or them for me to hand the papers to them and say, this is what they wrote in my class. How would you grade it? In other words, it's not in a an English vacuum. Writing is in a... throughout everything. Is anybody, and I'll start with you, Eric, because you're in a high school, okay, are the departments working together with writing? That to me makes perfect sense. Even scientific writing, look at that, you know.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I think there are schools who are still doing kind of writing across the curriculum models. Some schools have switched to a writing in the discipline models, meaning, hey, scientists write differently than historians write differently than, you know, the business community. And so trying to get students to think about how you position yourself as a writer through different disciplinary lenses.
Yeah.
So I think there's some of that, but I think, Larry, there's tons of opportunity to do more of those types of things. And again, it's always about kind of time, right? It's always how do we find time? How do we make sure we value this? How do we get this on our agendas, on our administration's agendas, so that we can sit down and have those cool conversations about students and their learning? But I think that's a great example of, again, of leaving your classroom and borrowing somebody else's expertise. In fact, with Deb and Keith, it was interesting because Deb had this great quote at the end of the whole project. She said, what I really realized was teaching them how to write correctly was not enough. They had to know the field that they were writing in, which goes back to what you were saying. It's a content question. You know, do they have the knowledge of the content to present themselves, in her case, for a job, to present themselves well? It might have been punctuated beautifully and formatted well and, you know, all in an active voice, but, you know, did they really know the substance of what they're talking about?
Exactly.
And that's, again,
exactly,
where we need to borrow that expertise from other teachers or community members.
It's really good stuff. And we only have a couple of minutes left. I want to swing back to Chris. Chris, I'm going to load this question for you, okay? How do teachers build their own assessment literacy to be able to do all this? And I know one of the answers is to buy the book from NCTE at the NCTE store, Our Better Judgment. That is the first step, Our Better
That's
Judgment.
That's correct.
The book. But what is the second step? Is there anything else beyond that? We got about 3 minutes.
Yeah, sure. It is true that the book includes lots of extended classroom examples, so teachers can read it and not only learn, again, what other teachers are doing, but how they're doing it, and there's things that they could photocopy and use in their own classrooms if they wanted to. It's certainly the case that they could read books or take graduate courses, but I think we've touched on the most important piece, which is that they work together with their students and their colleagues. They work with people outside of their buildings as well in their communities. They build alliances because it's really really all about asking the right questions and trying to pursue answers to those questions. For us, being an expert doesn't mean that you know everything. Being an expert means you know how to ask the right questions. And the same thing with leadership, which we didn't really get a chance to talk about today, but the leadership chapter largely is about adaptive work and being a lead learner, not a lead knower, which to us, you're somebody who really knows how to mobilize people, including your students, certainly, but perhaps others as well, to gather information you need, to ask good questions, to make good decisions, to use, again, your best judgment.
Here, here. I love what you guys are doing. Okay. The book is Our Better Judgment. Chris Gallagher wrote it along with Eric Turley. Eric's at Kirkwood High School. What's the name of the team in Kirkwood? The Kirkwood Tigers or something? What is it?
The Kirkwood Pioneers.
The Pioneers. I should have guessed St. Louis being the gateway city. I got it.
There you go.
Okay. And Chris, my kid actually had an interview many years ago to play football at Northeastern, but he wound up going to Bentley. So there you go.
Well, we don't have a football team anymore, so that was probably.
I know you
don't.
I know it probably was because it's so stupid to stand out in the middle of the field in your underwear all through the 9 weeks of the season. It's no sense for that. Okay, that was a joke.
Yeah.
Okay. What is the name of that? Actually, what's Northeastern's team name? I forget.
Huskies.
You have hockey. The Huskies. Thank you. I couldn't remember it. Okay.
Yeah, great
hockey
team.
Well, anyway, guys. Yeah, you do. Frozen. Northeastern.
We just beat
division,
BC in the Beanpot.
I know that, and I'll tell you something. People don't understand college hockey. Okay, they look at the big fights in the NHL. Division I college hockey is great, and
you bet.
If the kids drop their gloves, the game stops and they're tossed, and then the game begins again.
Right.
Okay, it's not like the
it
NHL.
Can be done.
Yeah,
right.
it can be done, and nobody misses it at Division I level. Okay,
right.
They need to get rid of that fighting crap in the NHL. Division I hockey is just great. And my kids grew up next to New Hampshire, so we go over to UNH all the time, over to Lively Snively and go over there. Okay, Chris, Eric, thanks a million, guys. This was great.
Pleasure.
Have a good weekend.
Okay.
Thanks
very much.
All right,
thanks,
bye-bye.
Guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And again, that book is from NCTE. Go to ncte.org/store/OurBetterJudgment. Okay? And it's by Chris Gallagher and Eric Turley. Thank you. Thank you, Millie, for helping me set up today's show. And thank you, Great Books Foundation. Please, English teachers and all teachers, check this out. Great Books Foundation. They have their shared inquiry method of learning in their curriculum. It creates school success by improving students' critical thinking. Hello. Reading comprehension, writing, speaking, and listening skills. Going to make life easier for you. Greatbooks.org, and they tweet at GreatBooksFND. It's the Great Books Foundation. Okay, we're done for another week. Thanks, guys. You made the last show of the week terrific. We're only going to do shows on Monday next week. I'm heading down to New Orleans to see my son and daughter-in-law, but we'll be back the week of the 16th with a full schedule of shows. You can check it all at the website, education-talkradio.org. where we are going to archive this show, and we have every other show we've ever done. Just keep scrolling down, education-talkradio.org. We'll change the website tomorrow morning for our Monday shows. Follow us on Twitter at EduTalk Radio. My name's Larry Jacobs, K-12 Education Talk Radio. I'll talk to you on Monday. Thanks so much. Have a great day.